Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Thought we'd visit Afghanistan today. We haven't been there for a while with everything that's been happening in Syria and in the other areas of the world. But one of the things that's been disturbing is the security forces killing our troops over there, Jim. What is happening, and is this been something that's been going on for a while, correct?
Yes. As we pointed out in Strategy Page, overall casualties to foreign troops has been declining this year. And attacks by Afghan police and soldiers on foreign troops has been going up. And indeed, it's become a larger percentage of overall casualties because the roadside bomb, the IED casualties, have also been going down. They're down to like 40% or something like that. And the friendly fire casualties are about 13%, which is twice what they were, a year ago. But the fact is that most of the friendly fire casualties are a result of more foreign troops being working closely with more Afghans, because the Afghan security forces, which is over 300,000, people right now, has greatly expanded in the last, 2 years, because by 1914, they're supposed to be in charge. And that's, less than 2 years away. So the media makes a big thing about it, but when you look at it, the devil is in the details, as the old saying goes. When you look at the details, it's not that unusual. It has been going on for a while. There's more of it, mainly because there's more opportunity. And most of it, as even the mass media finally stumbled, a lot of mass media defense reporters read Strategy Page. I know that from personal experience. They realize that the reasons for this are rarely Taliban infiltration, although Taliban is always quick to take credit. A lot of it is simply, and we've pointed this out for years, that violence in Afghanistan overall throughout the culture is extremely high. For example, child abuse, horrendous. And this never seemed to make the news. Eventually it did when some of the NGOs, maybe it was Doctors Without Borders or whatever, started to make a lot of noise about it because they wanted more money, to deal with it. But the fact of the matter was, Afghans beat their and inflict injury on their children to a much higher degree than is common in the West. Now, this is not unusual in a tribal society. Everybody does things a little differently, but they also do them a lot more violently in Afghanistan. The one thing that has not changed in Afghanistan, that is at the core of all problems, is the corruption. That is a battle that is not sexy, so it doesn't get much coverage. We have a hard time covering it because, there's no hook, as the saying goes. What do you talk about? You sum it up very quickly. What percentage of the tens of billions of dollars that we've given them have disappeared? It's high. Not as high as in some places. In Somalia, it's 70% disappeared. In Afghanistan, it's closer to 50%. But despite attempts at installing Western auditors, many of whom get shot at and killed, trying to supervise the use of the money by people, again, who get shot at and intimidated or sometimes outright killed, the money still gets stolen. It's basically a huge piñata, that old Mexican thing, the doll you hit with and it's full of candy and what have you. That's what they've always considered foreigners basically a source of loot. I mean, that's you know, there are a whole bunch of old Afghan sayings regarding that. Oh, look at the loot coming down the street. You know, talking about tourists in the 1960s. So, you know, this is a culture thing, which, again, for some reason, the media doesn't like to touch. I mean, I get it from Afghans and from people who work over there as well as soldiers. But somehow, you know, the mass media never, maybe it's not politically correct. I really don't know. I mean, it's not, for anybody who's into anthropology or sociology, this is, you know, bizarre by our standards, but it's what they call culture clash. Any tourist encounters it, especially if they get out in the countryside. If you've got a war going on at the same time, plus a country that is a hotbed of Islamic terrorism and the producer of most of the world's heroin, not to mention a lot of the hashish, you're going to have problems because of these cultural differences, especially if they involve a lot of guys with guns who are supposedly on your side that occasionally open fire, either because, A, they don't like you, nothing to do with religion or, you know, with the Taliban. B, you've caught them stealing stuff. That's a fairly common cause of this firing. Or they just had a bad day and they're, and it's really mundane. I've heard from advisors saying, you know, the first thing they tell you when you're going in country, they tell you actually before you get there, they have these little email, these web-based briefings where you can actually talk to people already there. And they start telling these anecdotes. There are some FAQs, which unfortunately civilians can't get access to, but frequently asked question lists, which just lists with anecdotes, all the things you should avoid or look for when dealing with armed Afghans. So it's almost, an inside joke that, you know, armed Afghans, no matter whose side they're on, these are things you got to watch for. They are trying. I mean, this is something we've been after the Afghans for years to pay more attention to. The Afghans say, you know, what are you talking about? That's the way we are, pal. They have tightened up on the screening because one thing they discovered with the screening, surprise, surprise, was that all these screening protocols were put in place over the last 5 years, not just to keep the dummies out, but also to keep, you know, Taliban, paid spies, whatever, people working for the drug gangs. And of course, what was happening was the jobs were jobs. I mean, this is a country with a lot of unemployment, always has had a lot of unemployment. And people who were in charge of recruiting were demanding bribes to, you know, let you in into the police or the military. And if you paid the bribe, they didn't screen you at all. They took the money. That was the only screening. That was the only incentive they needed. And you went. So the Taliban would just give the guy, one of their spies, the amount of the bribe, and he'd walk in and say, hey, I want to be a policeman. Okay, here. I got your money. There you go. You're signed up. They put a kibosh on this. It's not going to go completely away, but they basically stamped on the more outrageous, application of this backsheesh. So the update on Afghanistan, not much has changed. It just sounds different.
Austin, what's your view of what's going on over there?
Well, Jim certainly got the cultural and historical, overwhelming cultural and historical facts on his side, but there are just, in my view, Dan, there have been enough of these green on blue attacks, as they're called, that instantly got global press focus. Of course, the reports come from the NATO and U.S. Headquarters, International Security Force quarters as well, give them reports out. But some of it looks to me like that there was concerted effort by the Taliban or Haqqani Network. You know, take your pick. Sometimes they're the same. Oftentimes they're not. Either get an infiltrator in or find someone willing for a price, including we'll take care of your family for the rest of their lives, to launch one of these attacks. And then the media focus, of course, during an American presidential election is to sell the message. All the Afghanis hate you Americans. We know they don't like foreigners in general, but here's the message, and to use it in a kind of a very low grade, Tet offensive type information war type to action on the battlefield, or in this case, terrorist violence or murder. Now, it's not really comparable in size or quality to Tet type offensive or a simultaneous dozens of simultaneous suicide bomb attacks or, executed to show the coordination capabilities of resistance groups or insurgent groups. And maybe the best they've got. But there is that component to it. So I add that to the mix to think about at least how it is portrayed and interpreted.
Now, as the... Jim,
yeah.
Will things get worse as we get closer to that 2014 date?
Well, in theory, no. The Taliban believe that it's best to, keep your heads down because when most of the foreign troops are gone, we'll have a field day because we'll only have to deal with the Afghans who can be bribed as well as killed, shot at. The problem is, and this has been something that the Taliban leadership has recognized for years, is that the Taliban have turned into a gangster organization. They are considered thugs, not liberators. Initially they played the, hey, you're occupied by these foreigners, we're Afghans, let's go Afghans, Afghanistan for the Afghans, et cetera, et cetera. That did play for a while, but as cell phones spread and basically more Afghans learned about what was going on throughout Afghanistan and the rest of the world, they realized these Taliban guys are a bunch of gangsters because they were living off the people. Either you voluntarily gave them shelter and food and money and whatever, or they simply pointed a gun at you and took it. They often forced, you to, provide your daughters for a marriage, sometimes only for a night. It got pretty ugly. And now you're getting more reports, and this has been going on for years, of local militias. Now, the United States military had a policy of encouraging this militia stuff, and they found that a lot of rural communities basically told the Americans, look, if we can just sit this out, that's fine with us. We don't want, there's been too much war. And they got to remember, the place has been a carnal charnel house, for over 20 years. Even though the Afghans are more rambunctious than most, they've had enough. And the Taliban basically kept pushing it. Now, the Taliban leadership, and we reported on this, like I say, for years, the Taliban leadership would change field commanders, would keep on issuing fatwas and instructions and what have you. But the basic problem was the Taliban could not confront the foreign troops and survive. And in the last 3 years, since they've got all those MRAPs in there, the roadside bomb thing has just been becoming less and less effective. And if they use it against the Afghan forces, which they are doing, it doesn't have any impact because it just makes the Afghan troops, angrier, and they come after you because the whole idea of blood feud, is very popular in Afghanistan. And while all this is happening, the Taliban are trying to live off the civilians, and the civilians are tired of it. The Taliban basically recruit from the civilian population, the young guys who basically see no future, not many jobs, and there's no education, and light bulbs are going on in Afghanistan. They realize, well, who's behind a lot of this? Who is the ones who are stopping the foreign aid projects to build roads so we can get our surplus, vegetables or whatever, food, to the market so we can have some money, to buy medicine or, smartphones or whatever. Who are the ones coming in and basically telling us how to live, which is what got the Taliban in trouble in the 90s, which is why the Taliban were still fighting Afghans in after 9/11, and they collapsed so quickly. So basically the Taliban, which got strong mainly because of their alliance with the drug gangs. The drug gangs needed, you know, armed muscle. The Taliban needed money. It was a, you know, a match made in hell. And it kept them going for a while. But the drug gangs, as we point out in the strategy page, they only profit. They only, the money only trickles down to about 10% of the population. And in fact, in most parts of Afghanistan, you got no heroin production. The locals will not allow it. It's not that they don't like making a lot of money that way. It's just that they've seen there are over a million addicts, mostly of opium and hashish, in Afghanistan, and nobody wants a part. Life is hard enough without having a child or a cousin or whatever, or your husband, you know, have turned into a drug addict zombie. Which can be, you know, a matter of life and death in Afghanistan, where people are living so close to the edge. So the Taliban have basically worn out their welcome. So come 2014, the Taliban, even if they hang on, which they're basically trying to do in most parts of the country, they're not going to have much traction. So the Taliban are faced with a situation now where they have fewer and fewer friends and fewer opportunities. And this largely goes unreported, because this is good news, and good news is not news. You want something exciting, which is why the media gloms onto, you know, the friendly fire attacks. But the underlying situation is not good for the Taliban. It's also not good for Afghanistan, because they face the same situation as occurred in many South American countries, which took turns becoming the center of the cocaine industry. And, being the host, as it were, of a major, producing a very highly addictive drug, is ruinous. I mean, it destroys the culture and the economy and the political fabric. Same thing happened in northern Burma, you know, the old Golden Triangle. That's why these places where drugs are produced, it doesn't last. Eventually, the locals say, enough, you're gone, you guys are out of here. We like the money, hey, some of us even like the drugs, but you're totally destructive. And the same process is repeating itself in Afghanistan, and it's a battle between the people who realize, who basically said, hey, what's happened? Why are we suddenly the capital of heroin production? I mean, heroin's been around for over 100 years. What happened to the other places that were the capitals? Well, those other places decided, we don't want to be the capital of heroin production. And the problem in Afghanistan is that the 10% of the population who's benefiting from this are heavily armed. They still have, thousands of armed Taliban on their payroll, and they're not easy to dislodge because, again, Afghanistan is a place where everything is for sale. Well, you can't, as the saying goes over there, you can't buy an Afghan, but you can lease them for a while. Just got to keep an eye on them because they tell you when the lease is up, not the other way around. And this is something that's going to go on after 2014, no matter what anybody does. And this is something nobody wants to admit. Nobody wants to admit that it's really the Afghans who are in charge of what goes on. And the foreign inputs are basically background noise as far as the Afghans are concerned. That's an ugly truth which, you know, will in time become, you know, recognized. But right now it's just something everybody'd rather, you know, it's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to acknowledge.
Austin, you know, I get an interesting picture of things going on over in Afghanistan because I look for photos of what's going on over there. And one of the things that I've noticed is that we've started to tear apart some of our forward operating bases. And so the pullback has already started. What sort of effects is that going to have as we get closer to 2014?
Well, Dan, I've read some of the things that you read as well. I've noticed that a lot of these, some of these were observation posts had been occupied for quite some time. My understanding of it is that some of them are saying are in places that first of all, the basic decision is the troops could be used better in a different place. Some of these areas have been where the Afghan police, as corrupt and inefficient as they are, have been supposedly moved in, trained Afghan police have been moved into the area. At the tactical level, it's tough to tell whether you're giving up on a zone. That's the typical media interpretation of it, or you're adjusting because of the arrival of trained local Afghans, or you've made a deal with a local Afghan militia of the type that Jim was describing, which is we're tired of being fleeced by the drug gangs and the Taliban and everyone else. We'll mind. We'll take care of our own sector. Those kind of deals do occur. Here's my concern, and that is that the betrayal is that the United States primarily, but NATO pulling back and pulling out, the kind of Afghanis that Jim describes is saying, we're fed up with being taken advantage of by criminals and corrupt politicians and vicious tribal militants of various stripes. We want to modernize. We want to integrate in the way we want to integrate, but we want to integrate with the rest of the world. The message that they get is that you're abandoning us. And the way you counter that message is like, no, we're not. You, again, are going to have to make an internal arrangement as time moves forward. We're not going to be here forever. But at the same time, you back that up by saying, you know, we're going to have long-term commitments to ensuring your stability. We want you to take the responsibility for your own security, but we'll back you up. And that political diplomatic message has been missing in action. It's been missing in action in Europe. It's not just something that's gone unspoken consistently and publicly in the United States. The U.S. is leading nation in Afghanistan, and it's the responsibility of the U.S. government to deliver that message. Instead, what's happened is it's almost as Afghanistan, except for the green-on-blue attacks, has dropped out of the political dialogue.
What I'd like to wrap this up with is just ask you both the question. We'll let Jim answer it first, then let you finish up, Austin, and let you have the last word. But is Afghanistan better off today than it was 10 years ago or 11 years ago when we first went in?
Oh, yes. Jim? You can tell that by the fact that most of the refugees from the Russian invasion, who were, there were about 4 or 5 million of them in Iran and Pakistan, have returned home. And the ones who didn't are being forced out now, because the ones who didn't return are the ones that basically literally started a new life in Iran and Pakistan, and they have to be coerced into going home. But most of them had not. They were just scraping by in the refugee camps. And after 9/11, things started getting better. And yeah, the GNP has gone up. The heroin trade was there before 9/11. It's still there, but the rest of the economy has grown. There's been a lot of positive things done, especially most of the news you hear is from the south, where in Kandahar and Helmand, where the heroin is, and the Pushtuns are and the Taliban are. But in the north, in most of the country, there's been a lot of economic growth. Railroads are being built, hard surface roads are being built. Things are flourishing. You don't hear about that again because good news isn't news. That they are much better off. And most Afghans want to keep it that way.
Well, there have been some huge ore deposits found up north too, of rare minerals like that.
Yes, and the important thing is they're up north, where you don't have the Taliban, where the locals can basically decide, if Australia can get rich on all this, shipping all this crap to China, why not us? There is that attitude up north. Again, unlike Australia, where the politics can be complicated, you do have to make deals with all the tribes and what have you. There will be corruption, but they have a shot. Again, because railroads are coming in for the first time ever, to actually put major economic enterprises into Afghanistan and make a lot of Afghans not be obsessed about getting out of the country.
Austin?
Definitely better off. I mean, you could definitely better off in 2003 than they were in September of 2001. Definitely better off in 2005. Definitely better off in 2007. And the now you're even saying as bad as it is, as creaky as it is, and as corrupt as it is, an Afghan government that has some capacities. I don't know where it's respected or who respects it and the like, but it's got some growing internal capacities. It's a very slow process. It is nation building. It's industrial policy, anthropology, and economic. In some cases, it's absolute the basics of economic creating an economy. But they've had the ability to do it. As one Afghani told me when I was there in 2005, he had been educated in the West. He says, "You got to understand something about my country." He says, "I was here in 1972 and 73, you know, just as prior to the about the time of the fall of the king." And he said, "You know, we had a consensus among the major groups." He was not saying tribes, clans, or like, but that's what he meant. Forward looking, and he says the revolutions and wars just destroyed us. Then the Russians invaded, and he says this country's been at war for over 30 years. And he says, how are we going to start to rebuild it? We've got to have some type of security, and it's going to take some type of international connection. And I was chatting with a guy. He had worked as a translator for the U.S. because he spoke fluent English. You could say, well, sure, he's just giving you a line that Americans want to hear. No, there are people like him, and there are plenty of people like him, and that's the folks that say, yeah, things are better. And we've seen it. It's better. We've had an opportunity. At the same time, they're fighting an entire array of interests, religious fanatics, drug cartels, and that want to destroy them. So it's a tough, long struggle, but they are better off.
Well, we'll end it there, gentlemen, and talk to you next time.
All right.
Thank you, Dan. Bye.
Bye.